White Jürgen, the Vogue, presented his tally sticks and knotted strings and gave an accounting of the Lord's Saland for the past harvest year. The free tenants attended this recital with keen interest, comparing the hare's increases to their own with the sort of subtle arithmetic available to those who owned no numbers beyond their fingers. Willemer, the hare's clerk of accounts, himself but a few years removed from haying and mowing, transcribed everything in neat minuscule onto a parchment roll of sheets glued together side by side. He cast his sums on an abacus and announced that the hare owed Jürgen 27 pfennig to balance the account. Afterward, old Friedrich, the steward's clerk, took account of fines and dues. Like Willemer, he cast his sums in Fibonacci's Arabic numbers, but he translated the results into the Roman sort for his fair copy. This introduced grave chance of error, since old Friedrich's grasp of Latin numbers was little better than his grasp of Latin grammar, where he frequently confused the ablative with the dative. "If I write the words in Latin," the man explained one time, "I must write the numbers in Latin also." The first fine was butail for old Rudolf from Pforzheim, who had died on Sixtus Day. The hare took possession of his best beast, a breeding sow called Isabella, and naturally all men debated whether this was, in fact, Rudolf's best beast, rendering a variety of opinions, no two of which were compatible. Felix Ackermann stood to pay merchet on his daughter, but Manfred, who had been following matters from his seat beneath the linden, announced a commutation in view of the man's losses in the fire. This drew admiring murmurs from the assembly, which Dietrich deemed cheaply bought. The hare could be generous in small matters. Trude Metzger astonished everyone by paying merchet on herself for the Lord's permission to marry at will. This set all the women's tongues a-wagging, and cast a pall of apprehension upon all the single men. The hare, greatly amused, granted the boon. And so it went, while the sun climbed high. Heinrich Altenbach was fined 4 pfennigs in Chevage for living off the manor without the Lord's grace. Petronella Lerm had gleaned the hare's fields contrary to the prohibitions of autumn. Fulk Obrecht's son had stolen Trude's grain during the harvest. The jurors questioned the witnesses closely, and knowing the parties concerned, recommended the fines. Oliver Becker had raised the hue and cry against Bertram Unterbaum on May Day past in malice over the affections of Anna Kohlmann. Reinhard Wendt had appropriated 3 furrows from all the strips abutting his headland. For this offence the man was widely hooted, for there was to the manse peasant no greater crime than stealing a furrow from a neighbour. Manfred himself brought suit against 12 gartners, who during the July hay harvest had refused to load the haycocks into the carts. Nicol Engerman claimed that the labour had been done in prior years out of love for the hare, but was not actually required by the Weistumer. He asked that the free tenants inquire into the matter, and Everhard appointed an inquest from among the jurors. At this, the court recessed for a board of bread and ale at the hare's expense. "Langemann fancies himself a Schultheiss," said Lawrence as the crowd broke up. "He's always finding bylaws that say he doesn't have to work." "Enough such findings," Dietrich said, "and no one will hire him, since then he won't work at all." Max Schweitzer appeared and led him a little distance from the others.
"The hare bade me inquire about the black powder," he murmured.
"Their alchemist recognized charcoal from the specimens," Dietrich told him, "and sulfur by its properties and appearance, but the Heinzelmunken knew not what Krentish word signified nitre. So we are at an impasse. I told him it was commonly found under dung piles, but their shit differs from ours."
"Perhaps it smells sweeter," Max suggested. "And if we give him a specimen, of nitre, I mean, alchemists can identify unknown materials, nay?"
"Yeah, but the Krenken seemed disinclined to make the effort." Max cocked his head.
"I wouldn't think their inclinations mattered."
"They have angst to repair their ship and return to their own country." Dietrich looked off to where Manfred stood with his retinue. The men were laughing over some matter, and Kunigund, her gown wrapped in a white girdle, embroidered in orfois with scenes of stag hunting and hares, was torn between a ladylike dignity in Eugen's company and the desire to chase her younger sister, who had just tugged Kunigunde's cap loose. Manfred thought to hold the Krenken against their will so he could learn their occult secrets. "The hare would be wise not to press the matter," he said.
"On his own land? Why not?"
"Because the strong arm should be gently used on folk you suspect of having black powder." In the afternoon, the villagers elected beer tasters, jurors, wardens, and other ministers for the coming harvest year. Veit Jürgen declined the honor and potential expense of another term as Vogt, so Volkmar Bauer was elected in his stead. Klaus was chosen again as Meyer. Seppel Bauer shyly cast his first vote, raising his hand for Klaus along with the other householders, or with almost all, for Trude Metzger loudly dissented, and as she was householder for her manse, cast a lone vote for Gregor.
"The mason may be a dimwit," she declared, "but he's not a thief who damps the meal."
Gregor, turning to Dietrich, said, "She sweet-talks me to win my affection." Lawrence, on the other side, wagged his finger.
"Remember, Gregor, should you ever seek to remarry, that she has already paid Merchacht on herself, so she would be a cheap catch,
and worth every pfennig."
"The body is but a mantle," said Theresia Gresh, breaking a silence she had held throughout the day, "which shines if true beauty lies within. So she seems plainer than she is."
"Perhaps you are the one to light her lamp," Lawrence told Gregor. Gregor scowled, now more than half worried that his friends were plotting his remarriage. "Man would need a bonfire for that undertaking," he grumbled.
Dietrich had named his nocturnal visitor Johann von Stern, John of the Stars. He resumed his visits to the Lazaretto, and slowly his confidence returned. The creatures would glance his way when he arrived, pause a moment, then calmly resume their activities. None threatened him. Some worked diligently on the ship. Dietrich watched them play fire across certain seams and spray fluids and spread colored earths upon its surfaces. Air, no doubt, also figured in the repairs, for he sometimes heard the hissing of gases deep within the nether regions of the structure. Others occupied themselves in natural philosophy, in bizarre and patternless leaping, or in solitary walks and idleness. Some perched in trees like birds. As the autumn forest became a blaze of color, they used wonderful instruments, photographia, to capture miniature light drawings of the leaves. Once Dietrich recognized the alchemist by his more particular clothing, squatting in that peculiar knees-above-head posture, overlooking the stream where it tumbled over an escarpment. He hailed him, but the creature, absorbed in some contemplation, made no response, and thinking him in prayer, Dietrich quietly withdrew. Dietrich felt a growing frustration with Krenkish laggardness. "I have seen your carpenters taken from their tasks," he told the Kratzer on one visit, "to collect beetles or flowers for your philosophers. Others I have seen playing with a ball or leaping up and down to no apparent purpose. Indeed, sporting themselves naked. Your most urgent task is the repair of your ship, not why our trees change color."
"All those who do the work," the Kratzer announced.
Dietrich thought he meant that philosophers were unskilled in shipbuilding, which was no astonishing insight. "Even so," he insisted, "there may be apprentice tasks you could perform." At this, the Kratzer's antennae stiffened to rods, and his features, never expressive, grew more still yet. Hans, who had been occupied to the side cataloguing images of plants and paying no apparent attention to the discourse, sat upright in his seat with his hands poised over the array of types by which he had instructed the Hanselmanken. The Kratzer's eyes pinned Dietrich to his seat, and Dietrich gripped the sides of his chair in unaccountable terror.
"Such labor," the Kratzer said finally, "is for those who perform such labors."
The statement had the seeming of a proverb, and like many proverbs, suffered from a conciseness that reduced it to a tautology. He was reminded of those philosophers who, grown lately besotted with the ancients, affected their prejudice against manual labor. Dietrich could not imagine himself shipwrecked and unwilling to assist his fellows in the necessary repairs. In such straits even the gently born would put a hand to the task. Labor, he pointed out, has its own dignity. Our Lord was a carpenter, and called to himself fishermen and tent-makers and other humble folk. Pope Benedict, may he rest in peace, was the son of a miller.
Did I hear the utterance correctly? The Kratzer said. A carpenter may become a lord. Wah, wah, wah. Can a stone become a bird? Question. Or are all your lords base-born? Question.
I grant you, Dietrich admitted, that a man born into his besitting will seldom rise above it. Yet we do not despise the working man.
Then we are not so different, your folk and mine, the Kratzer said. For us too, our besitting is written. I think you would say it is written into the atoms of our flesh.